It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strangeamps. We're going to start today's show with a story that may sound familiar. A story about an oil pipeline on native land and a small tribe up against a major corporation. But before we do that, we need to go for a walk. Way up in northern Wisconsin, to the home of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, a tribe of the Ojibwe, where early one morning, Mike Wiggins, the former chairman of the Bad River Band, took a visiting film director for a walk along the shore.
We stop just at the mouth of Lake Superior where it meets the Bad River and get out on a beach. And I look down and I see these beautiful stones.
Oh.
What do I do?
This is Mary Mazio, the director of the documentary Bad River.
Oh yeah, it's bad. I lean over, I grab that stone, and I immediately knew what I had done. And Mike said to me, "Let me just see what you have." I said, "Oh, let me put it back." I knew exactly what I had done. I was just self-aware enough to know that, oh, this was an epic fail.
To be honest, I pick up stones on beaches all the time. I live in Wisconsin. The rocks along the shores of Lake Superior are famously beautiful. People collect them. I had no idea that the Ojibwe consider some of those stones sacred. Until Mary told me this story, it just didn't occur to me. Because that's not how I was raised to see the world.
Our American viewpoint, myself embodied by it, right, is you look around and everything is there for us for the taking.
Mm-hmm.
I will take that. That is going to serve me. As opposed to the values that I started to learn, by the way, in a really awkward way, but the Ojibwe value system, which was long-term, group-oriented, and we are thinking of each other and not about ourselves.
Our theme this hour is tribal sovereignty. But as we found again and again in producing this show, Native Americans and white people speak two fundamentally different languages when it comes to land rights. We have different ideas about how to treat land, how to live on and with it, and especially about whether land can even be owned.
Land is something to benefit all of us. And of course, we have this private ownership imposed over us. But the Ojibwe, who have been here for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, never viewed land in that vein. It was co-use. How do we use this together? And in fact, when you go back and look at some of the old treaties, the understanding by the Ojibwe was, we're not granting you private ownership of this land, which would be the state of Wisconsin or the state of Michigan, right? What we are doing is we're granting you the ability to go and harvest timber. They did not intend to cede land because it wasn't even a thing, private ownership.
The tribe has experienced this for hundreds of years. The timber companies came here before, and this is just a new company coming here using old tactics. We're bringing you guys jobs, we're bringing you guys money.
Here's the mighty green dollar, and take it and it'll all be good. But then what are you losing?
When there's a spill and there's no water to drink, can you drink your dollars that you get? I don't think so.
We love our land more than we love the money, that's what I said.
When you see money as more of a commodity and a necessity than your own water, rice, and land, they did kill you. They killed that part of you that's connected to it. They killed that part of your mind that remembers what your grandpa had to do, what his grandfather had to do.
It's in my blood memory that this land is the most important thing that there is, because everything else can be gone.
That's from Bad River, the documentary Mary Mazzio made about a small band of Lake Superior Chippewa and their legal battle to get rid of an oil pipeline called Line 5, built and owned by Enbridge, a Canadian energy company.
Enbridge paid less than $4,000 for the right to install and operate a 12-mile pipeline over Bad River land without tribal consent. That happened in 1953, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs was effectively rubber stamping major swaths of Native land for commercial exploitation. And for 40 years, Enbridge had a free ride to extraordinary profitability with almost no benefit to the band.
How much was this pipeline worth?
We found documentation that suggested that on an annual basis, there is $600 million of cash flow related to Line 5 on an annual basis.
Wow. So the agreement, the historic agreement that the corporation made has expired. And the tribe decided, we do not want this pipeline on our land. Take it off. You're trespassing. That seems so cut and dried. It seems so clear legally. Why has this turned into a big battle?
Enbridge, as is typical with many energy giants, in fact, many companies, these lines are so profitable that they are battling to continue operations as uninterrupted from their perspective as possible. And this, by the way, this happens all throughout Indian country. Extractors, whether it's mines or pipelines or dams, can, with impunity, disregard the terms of their contract because, well, sue us. You have a huge energy conglomerate with very sophisticated lawyers, and then you've got a very small band who is, you know, many of its residents are below the poverty line. It is a real David and Goliath fight.
It just seems like a pretty clear case about land sovereignty, right? This is a tribal nation.
Indeed.
They have a right to their land and to determine what goes on in their land. If the situation was reversed and Enbridge, a Canadian company, was running a pipeline that the U.S. had said, no, you can't run that on American territory, there wouldn't be an issue.
Enbridge has tried arguing unsuccessfully, by the way, because Judge Conley in the federal district court found that there's a clear trespass, but Enbridge continues to operate to this day without any recompense to the band. However, the issue has nothing to do with oil and everything to do with a piece of aging infrastructure sitting in the wrong place that shouldn't be operated contractually anymore and is today at profound risk of rupture. When the line was put in 1953, it was constructed about 350 feet away from the Bad River. At last check, there's been so much erosion at one piece of the Bad River that the pipeline is now 11 feet away.
What would happen if the pipeline burst?
If the pipeline bursts, you have 12 miles of oil across the Bad River Reservation. That oil will be in Lake Superior in a matter of hours. This is a terrifying prospect. People are panicked. And what's fascinating, I think, is at last count, Enbridge had offered the Bad River Band $80 million to settle the case, continue operations.
That's a lot of money for a small band.
And yet, the band does not define themselves in terms of money. That's such a short-term view, right? And they're like, look, we need to preserve Lake Superior for our seventh generation. And with extreme weather, more and more of this country will be drawing on Lake Superior. It's 10% of the world's freshwater resource. It's our job. And so when you think about it, you've got this tiny community fighting tooth and nail at huge personal expense. The legal fees have been overwhelming. The pressure, both internally and externally on the band, has been severe.
Because some people would like to take the $80 million?
Yes.
The Bad River Tribe won their lawsuit, right?
They did.
The federal judge said, yep, This is their land, Enbridge. Get off. Seems like a victory. What happens now?
Well, Judge Conley found that Enbridge, in fact, was in a state of trespass, and he gave the company until 2026 to be out. Enbridge appealed that decision to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. I do think that if I'm a betting person, that this is a case that goes to the Supreme Court.
Wow. So what's your sense of how all these land rights battles are going to play out in American law? I mean, are we looking at an era of relitigating or reinterpreting treaty rights? And is it possible that actually good could come out of this? Because so many of those treaty rights, if we look at them today, do seem deeply unfair, morally wrong. Certainly the way they've been interpreted seems wrong.
You're asking a really interesting question. And how the Supreme Court, if presented with this case, I think Judge Gorsuch has been very strong on native sovereignty. I think the idea that a contract is a contract is a contract, whether it's a treaty from 1854, whether it's an easement that expired in 2013, I think with a more conservative bench, hopefully you might see that being respected. But I think, I can't even venture a prediction, quite honestly. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in a case that came before her, basically stomped all over native sovereignty, saying, you know, quote unquote, the embers of sovereignty have long since been extinguished, something like that. You know, I'm a Kennedy Democrat. I'm from Massachusetts. I was horrified by the cavalier nature that sort of one of our more esteemed progressive jurists would take with respect to exactly what you're talking about, sovereignty and land rights. So I think you're asking a question that it's really difficult to chart. And we can only hope that with the next generation of young people that learn more about Native history and Native communities, understand that the race to protect land is the race to protect precious resources so that we can survive as a species. That's it, right? As opposed to the other side, which is, okay, how do we commercially exploit this for money? And it goes back to that divergent worldview that you talked about a few minutes ago, which is profound.
My little tribe is standing up and saying, we're protecting the water, not just for us. We're protecting water for the planet.
Not all of our decisions are based off of what's presenting itself from an Enbridge lens, but it's more of a deeper, more thoughtful, future-based decision as a sovereign about what we'd like to have here for our people in the future.
We have the right to say, look at the leases expired. Stop the flow, dig up the pipe, remediate the soil, and, you know, don't let the doors hit you, you're behind on your way out.
None of our old tribal councils gave away our sovereignty. None of them said, from this moment on, our tribe will exist and serve at the pleasure of the Enbridge pipe maintenance and operation.
And yet, here we are years later, and the company won't move.
The film is Bad River, a documentary directed by Mary Mazzio. You can see the trailer and learn more about it on our website at ttbook.org. One of the narrators of Bad River is a young woman with a well-known face in the land rights movement and in the fashion industry. Her name is Quanah Rose Chasing Horse. Raised in Eagle Village, Alaska, she's Hanquich-In on her mother's side and Ogallala Lakota on her dad's side. Quanah's in her early 20s, so she represents the next generation of activists working to protect Native lands. What is unusual is to combine that with a career as a high-profile supermodel. So when I was getting ready to talk with her, I was really struck by a cover shoot she did for a National Geographic issue on Native sovereignty. because it kind of epitomizes the two worlds she walks in. So in the picture, you're wearing this black parka with a furry hood and this really beautiful skirt that has images of Native children. And you are standing in front of this iconic stone monument that we've all seen. You're staring straight into the camera. And there's a look in your eyes that I keep thinking about, but I can't quite describe it. This must have been, you know, the end of a day. You're really steeped in this landscape and the stories of the people who've been living there. What were you thinking about?
Honestly, I think it was really just my ancestors that was speaking through me. If you really look at the image, I think that's why people, I've gotten that a lot, actually. I've gotten a lot of people being like, when I look at this image and I look into your eyes, it's hard for me to actually pinpoint what exactly is coming through me, but I feel it. I feel this energy. And for me, like in that moment when we were there shooting that, I genuinely felt the presence of not just my ancestors, but of my little brother and his lineage and their ancestors there, because it really just does speak to what we're trying to push through with this story. The vision and how we see ourselves and see the land and how we are able to recognize that we aren't separate from the land. We're not above the land. We're not below the land. We're not above nature. We're not below nature. We are in nature. And I think in that moment, I just kind of embodied that. And I felt my ancestors kind of looking through me. It really felt so, so grounding. And yeah, we were able to tell an amazing story with that. Yeah.
Will you tell me something about the place where you grew up in Alaska? Because you were lucky enough to grow up with this strong connection to indigenous lands and sacred places. And the way your mom raised you, from what I've read, in a traditional way. I'm just wondering what that meant, what that looked like in practice for you growing up.
Yeah. My mom, she raised me and my brothers as a single parent. And at first, we were homeless. My mom really struggled trying to provide for me and my brothers, but she was able to, and she did it all by herself. Being raised really close to the land, we lived out in the bush. We lived in a log cabin, and my mom had a dog team.
Wow.
I grew up dog mushing. I grew up hunting and fishing because we didn't really have the money to go to the store, the one or two stores that were like miles and miles away, yet they were the closest stores to us. They were pretty expensive just because it's hard to get food shipments all the way out there.
What kind of hunting and fishing?
Caribou hunting, moose hunting, fishing for salmon.
You've hunted caribou and moose?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I was really raised within our cultural, traditional way of life. I think my mom really made sure that me and my brothers had a healthy relationship with the land and the animals, because as a society, as a people, as humans, forget that we are a part of this life cycle, and that when you're living out in the bush of Alaska, it's survival. And it really was like that for me and my brothers. I mean, when my mom, you know, there were nights we were afraid that she wasn't going to come home because she had a really dangerous job. And so me and my brothers, she taught us how to cook, how to clean, how to take care of each other. She always made sure that we had the skills to survive in this world and not just in our traditional way of life and lands out in Alaska, but she made sure that we can also, I would say, like, show up and proceed and perform in today's society outside of the bush of Alaska in the city. So she really made sure that we had a balance and we understood both worlds. But yeah, walking two worlds, it can be tricky, but once you have a great community around you, it makes it a lot easier.
Which, in my mind, it just brings me back to thinking about you as a fashion model, which in some ways seems so anomalous, given everything that we've been talking about, your deep connection to and love for the land, and then modeling.
Yeah.
Which feels, well, I guess rather than me saying anything, I should just ask, how do those connect for you? Do you see part of your mission as redefining beauty?
Yes, I think one of the biggest things in fashion is redefining beauty in that way of breaking down those barriers, because that's the biggest thing about fashion is a lot of people don't even realize that Native people were so, so fashionable. Mm-hmm. Every tribe had different regalia, had different hairstyles, had different ways that they would show up in different communities. Like in Alaska, the messengers, the people that were sent to go trade with other Native communities, they would stop about a mile before they reach the next village, and they'll dress up their dogs even. Hmm. A lot of the dogs had outfits. The dogs were decked out in really nice, drenched in Native drip. You know what I mean? Like they really wanted to show up and show out because we are proud of who we are and where we come from. We're proud of our beauty. And I think when we're able to reclaim that and show the world that we're not a monolith, that each tribe had their own sense of style, had their own sense of fashion, but also our languages are beautiful. Our songs are beautiful. The way that we communicate with each other, even if we don't understand each other, is beautiful. And because it's beautiful, we love it.
Also, the traditional tattoos that you wear, I mean, that's a tradition that goes back generations and generations, hundreds of years, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we've been doing this since time immemorial. I mean, our tattoos are one of the most sacred practices that we have and that identifies who we are. Those kinds of traditions and teachings were stolen from us and erased. Genocidal tactics, it was to take everything that made us who we are away from us. And I think for over a century, no one in our tribe practiced tattooing for over a century.
Wow.
Me and my mom did a lot of research and talked with elders, and I was the first girl, the youngest to get it that young. I got my first one when I was 14, and I've experienced a lot of discrimination and a lot of just ignorance around it. There's so many things that go into that, but in my modeling career, no one, not a single person is allowed to ask me to cover my tattoos. I remember one time the stylist, he worked with me on one of my first shoots. He was like, not a fan of my markings. And he made it known, and it made me feel very weird about it. But I was like, whatever, he's obviously ignorant. He doesn't know anything about this. And then I saw him the next time, and I had added onto my markings. And he saw that I added to them, and he was like, did you add more? And I was like, yeah, I did. Don't add any more. He thought he had the authority to tell me, an Indigenous woman, to not get any more facial markings. And I definitely would say my traditional tattoos play a huge role in reclaiming of identity and showing up and being unapologetic and authentic in who I am and not compromising for anyone. Do not have any colonizer tell you that you can or cannot get something that is relating to you, your people, and your culture. Reclaim that power and don't let that affect you, because you're showing up authentic as who you are, and that's how it should be. It's powerful, you know, and it shows young girls and the youth and future generations that we are beautiful, that these markings are beautiful, that we should celebrate them and celebrate each other when we receive them. It's a beautiful, beautiful practice, and it's so, such an honor and a blessing to be a part of that space when you're there witnessing someone getting their marking.
Kwana Chasing Horse is Hanguich Inn and Ogallala Lakota. She was raised in Eagle Village, Alaska. Keep your eyes open for a new documentary about her life called Walking Two Worlds. And by the way, all the music in this hour was composed by Native musicians. This piece is from Mata Waiuhi, composer for the award-winning TV show Reservation Dogs and a member of the Lakota tribe.
Live from the shell of a turtle, about a snap, quail tail, broke spells, jump hurdles, where we at? Wish me well on the journey, might burn a might splat. Pop said you gon' learn how to earn a stripe, stick into your pathways, pitter patter with the wind as it brush the grass drains, revel in the river for a minute downstream with the fins, no means to an end, brown green colors got it at the mud, flooded in front line, give a whoop out a whoop. That's the sound of the cavalry. I don't keep it sweet, foul mouth, no ounce of a cavity. Just cause you mad with yourself, don't get mad at me.
To hear more of Mata Waiuhi and other Native artists we're featuring this hour, visit our website, ttbook.org. And while you're there, check out Quanah Chasing Horse's photos from National Geographic. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about Native sovereignty this hour, and I want to go back to a point I made in the beginning, which is that sovereignty is a concept most Americans probably don't think much about. Well, that changed for our producer Charles Monroe Kane recently, when he spent an evening gambling at a fancy casino run by Wisconsin's Potawatomi tribe. Blackjack, slots, roulette, sports betting, they're all legal on Native-owned land, because that's where tribes have sovereignty. And Charles got to wondering what exactly that means. So he sat down with Stephen Light, co-director of the Institute for the Study of Tribal Gaming Law and Policy at the University of North Dakota.
For most people in America, they don't think about sovereignty at all. But for Native Americans, they think about sovereignty every single day. Why don't your average Americans think about sovereignty?
I think we all take for granted that we live within a sovereign nation. When we talk about the government, when we think about decision-making on behalf of the American people, when we think about what it means to be an American citizen, all of those ideas have sovereignty wrapped up in them, but it's sort of like being a fish in water. We don't really consciously think about the implications. On the other hand, for a lot of tribal citizens, because of history, because of current circumstances, because of connections to community and the reservation structure, sovereignty can be a much more present idea on a daily basis.
If someone said to me, hey, are a Native American sovereign? I will say, no, the U.S. government could take away the rights at any moment they want. To me, a definition of sovereignty would be at least that another body above you can't take away your rights. And I don't see Native Americans of having full rights. Am I wrong?
You're not at all wrong. Sovereignty is very complex and complicated when it comes to tribes because of that long history that predates the existence of the U.S. Because when you overlay a U.S. Constitution, the creation of the United States on top of that, you still have these pre-existing indigenous nations residing on land that they were on first. And that land has new borders and new political and legal and regulatory implications for the people that are living on it. It's still all wrapped up inside the U.S. and inside the U.S. Constitution. So it's complicated.
Right.
Yeah.
The whole reason we're talking, though, isn't just about sovereignty. We're talking about gaming and how it relates to sovereignty. I do want to talk about the act from 1988, the Federal Indian Gaming Regulation Act. That's how gambling became legal for Native Americans. What happened?
In the late 1970s into the early 1980s, there were a few tribes that experimented with bingo halls, just bingo like you might find in a church basement, old style bingo for folks to come onto the reservation and play a game. It turned out to be a pretty good source of revenue. And so that created a question, a big question about how much control do tribes have over gaming activity or bingo activity on their own lands, and what kind of authority can the state exert over what the tribe is doing? That generated some court cases, as those things tend to do, and eventually that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. One of the most consequential and important both Indian law cases and certainly a case about sovereignty overall in the U.S. under the Constitution, in 1987, the U.S. Supreme Court basically held that tribes had sovereignty. They were able to open and operate bingo halls and other casinos on their lands, but that states might have some opportunity to regulate that as well.
And tax it too.
Yes, down the road. After that Supreme Court decision, the Congress passed a law called the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of 1988, under which all of Indian gaming operates today. So in just 35 years, we have a tribal gaming industry that has grown exponentially. It's a pretty big deal today.
Can you, in a nutshell, tell me about the Pequot Nation in Connecticut? If you asked a lot of Americans, their associations of casinos are to this tribe in Connecticut.
The Pequots in Connecticut are a really interesting and foundational story in relation to tribal gaming. If you've been to the Foxwoods Casino Resort in Connecticut, you can see that this is truly a casino and a resort that's on the scope of anything that you would find in Las Vegas and throughout the world. The story of the Pequots is fascinating also because they're a relatively recently recognized tribe. They had only a few hundred members at the time. And one of the first economic ventures that they sought to launch was a tribal casino, which in the early 90s, this was a pretty new thing to do. They looked to financing wherever they could get it, and they happened to get it from a Malaysian billionaire. And so when they built Foxwoods, it was big, it was splashy, it looked like a world-class destination, it had concert venues, wonderful hotel and new opportunities for people on the East Coast to come and play. And soon it was generating on the order of $1 billion. That's billion with a B a year.
Wow.
And so the Pequots also attracted a lot of attention at that time because most people didn't know or understand what is this new thing called tribal gaming. A lot of folks asked questions about what is tribal gaming? How do the Pequots get the right to open this? What does it mean for me?
But I think they're asking other questions that aren't very awesome. From The Simpsons, The Sopranos, people were questioning, hey, are these people really Native Americans? And the racism to me from the Pequot discussion was pretty intense. People didn't like it.
You're absolutely correct. The Pequots were, for a short period of time, almost the face of this new thing. Cartoons like South Park and The Simpsons and Family Guy would slip in a reference to grandma going to the tribal casino or getting lucky or not at the tribal casino. Some of it is just to make a joke. Some of it may have some questions about race and the relationship of American Indians to the rest of the U.S. You're right.
It seems to me that in America, non-natives have two responses to Indian casinos. First, I would say, why do they get to do it and we don't? And then the other response is, hey, there's still poverty and unemployment on reservations. They're misappropriating their profits. And both of them end with they shouldn't be allowed to do it.
Yeah, in thinking about Indian gaming over the years, number one, tribal gaming is different in that it's an outgrowth of tribal sovereignty. Number two, it is government gaming. So it's public gaming. It's more akin to a state lottery than it is to a commercially right. operated casino. And number three, that it has very real public policy purposes, which are intended to benefit tribal governments and tribal people, ranging from job creation to mitigating poverty to infrastructure, education, housing, et cetera, on the reservation and off. Those three things make tribal gaming very different than a commercial casino. If you think about a casino on the strip in Las Vegas, for example, what it's intended to do by generating revenue is completely different than in the tribal gaming context.
I'm going to go back to sovereignty because I have a quote here from you that kind of blew my mind, and I want you to explain it to me, and I'll read it to you. There is perhaps no greater opportunity today than Indian gaming to transcend the federal definition of tribal sovereignty and to allow for the eventual emergence and ultimate authority of tribes' inherent rights to self-determination. Really?
Well, look, we've only had tribal gaming for just over three decades. For something like Indian gaming to almost literally put tribes on the map in terms of their visibility, their political clout, their fiscal clout, their ability to negotiate and navigate the terrain of American politics or business or financing of different economic opportunities. It's tribal gaming that's almost literally put tribes on the map. And so in that sense, tribal gaming is much more than just about the casino floor. It's really about the authority and the jurisdiction and the power of tribes to flex their muscles in relation to all of these complex legal and political and cultural systems that they find themselves in throughout the U.S. one of the things that tribal casinos do is they really demonstrate to us that American Indians are here. They're in the 21st century. They're looking for the same kinds of opportunities that all Americans are. They share values that all Americans do. And so tribal gaming just helps to shine a spotlight on that.
Stephen Andrew Light is the co-director of the Institute for the Study of Tribal Gaming Law and Policy at the University of North Dakota, and Charles Monroe Cain talked with him. Coming up, a counter-narrative to Native American tragedy. I know you're taking...
That's not accurate. I don't love my reservation of Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota. I don't love my home because of the poverty and the hopelessness and the squalor. I know you're listening. There are many reasons, many good reasons, why I love and I'm connected to my tribal homeland, my reservation. I never really came across many books that explored the ways in which Native people had been not just surviving, but thriving and living and working and loving and doing all the things that fully realized human beings do the world over. Need you, want you. Need you, want you. There was no book, there was no source that explored the rich textures of our lived experience. Toni Morrison is famous for saying, if there's a book you want to read and it's not written, then it's probably up to you to write it. And so...
So this is what you've done.
This is what I've tried to do.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. And PRX. Speaking of Native voices, writer David Troyer thinks it's time for a new kind of Native American narrative, for work that is less centered around stories of hardship and what he calls trauma porn. Troyer himself is Ojibwe. He grew up on the Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota, went to Princeton, studied anthropology and creative writing under Toni Morrison, and he's published a string of award-winning books. Among them, a sweeping counter-narrative of Native American history called The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. Steve Paulson caught up with him.
You are not disputing the horrors of what happened to American Indians over the centuries. In fact, you call it the apocalypse, but you're saying that's only one part of the story.
Right. What I'm saying is that 1890, at the massacre at Wounded Knee, which for Dee Brown and so many others was the point at which Indian cultures and Indian tribes really ceased to exist as such, was not the end of anything. What I'm positing is that that was a very low point from which we have managed to work and create and claw and crawl to the present moment where we're doing amazing things.
What are some pieces of this post-1890 history that we should know about that we tend not to hear?
Well, for example, during the boarding school era, when it was federal Indian policy to forcibly remove Native American children from their families and send them to residential boarding schools where they were essentially whitewashed, or the attempt was made to whitewash them, deny them access to their families, deny them access to their homelands, deny them the opportunities to speak their native languages, prevent them from practicing their religion, cut their hair, dress them in a white man's clothes, Christianize them, etc. This was a horrific experience that two or three generations of Native children went through. And the purpose of these residential boarding schools was to destroy the Native family as a locus for political and cultural power. In some ways, the boarding schools succeeded, but in other ways, there were unintended consequences. You took Native kids, Ho-Chunk kids, Ojibwe kids, Lakota and Dakota children, and you threw them all in boarding school together. And during this assault on their personhood, they became friends with one another. They formed alliances, they made relationships, they got married, they had children, they formed connections. In the past, our tribes were oftentimes separated by language and experience and geography. But one of the unintended side effects of the residential boarding school system was that Native people from vastly different tribes came together, got to know one another, and then once they graduated, continued to work together in common cause. So there was an outgrowth of intertribal work.
You're suggesting then that there was maybe almost more of a common sense of Native identity, whereas before it was sort of separated into distinct tribal identities.
Exactly so. That's exactly right, Steve. It was really just, in so many ways, a painful experience. And that's what our reporting has often focused on. But it was a generative experience, too. So that's one example of a thing that the government tried to do to us and partially succeeded, but we turned it into something else that worked in some ways to our benefit.
Yeah. Now, you write about how the identity politics of being Native has changed tremendously since when you were a kid growing up on the reservation. And you talk about how it used to be that you were evaluated on how dark your skin was or basically how much you had suffered to sort of be a, quote, real Indian. And now it is very different. You say there's a lot more diversity now. You're not sort of boxed into these particular tropes. What has changed?
Yeah, so much has changed. I mean, when I was a kid and you'd meet Native people you didn't know, there's this weird coded kind of conversation that would ensue about where you're from and what your family's like. Then you'd start telling jokes and telling stories. And there was a way in which you tried to prove your bona fides by talking about how much drama there was in your family or how hard things were, or how poor you might have been or who might have gotten arrested or the big mistakes you've made or how drunk you got or whether you were enrolled or how dark you were. Those were the sort of ways in which Native people would figure out if the other Native people you were talking to were for real, quote unquote. That has kind of changed. We've begun to value other things than our suffering. The same games are played, but they're more along the lines of, you know, do you speak your language? Do you go to ceremony? Do you harvest? Do you hunt? Do you trap? Do you pick wild rice? Do you tap trees, maple trees in the spring? Those kinds of things. I can't help but see all of this as a real positive change, that we're now sort of figuring out who's in and who's out based on how we practice our culture rather than how much we suffer. It's changed for a lot of reasons. It used to be 50 years ago that if you were a traditional Indian, you were seen by other Indians as backwards and as ignorant. But now, if you're a traditional Indian, you're seen as having something really valuable to contribute, not just to the tribe, but to our modern existence. That coupled with the degree to which Native people are on social media, Native Twitter and Native Facebook and Native Instagram and all of that stuff is huge. And for people who are poor and geographically scattered and lack access often to education and transportation and capital and things like that, connecting online has sort of enabled us to recognize one another and embrace one another in so many different ways. So, you know, you can be like a Native American power lifter or a fitness competitor, and you'll have all these strong connections with Native food harvesters in New Mexico. And like, there's all these different ways in which Native people of vastly different walks of life connect on social media. And like in the boarding school days are building bridges and accepting one another and celebrating the diversity of Native life that is modern Native life. It's really exciting. It's fun.
One other thing that's happened, especially in the last decade, is a certain resistance movement, particularly what happened at Standing Rock. These incredible protests, these people who gathered together in this one place to protest against this pipeline that was scheduled to go right through the reservation. Where does Standing Rock fit into modern Native identity?
Even though Standing Rock didn't end in a victory for the protesters or for the Standing Rock Reservation, it did have a lot of positive effects. We saw a lot of activism with the American Indian Movement starting in the late 60s and through the first half of the 1970s, from 1970 to 75. And AIM had the effect of raising the visibility of Native people in the national consciousness to a large degree, and that was positive. But there were a lot of drawbacks to the American Indian Movement, and there's a lot of damage that the movement itself did. A lot of misogyny, a lot of sexual violence was sort of associated with the movement or resulted because of the behavior of a lot of its leaders. it was a movement that was sort of vested in and committed to a path of violence, which isn't necessarily the wrong move. Sometimes violence is called for, I have to say. So AIM was a mixed bag, but in many ways it was very destructive. Standing Rock, the protest at Standing Rock, was very different. There were women in positions of leadership, not so much the story with AIM. There was a way in which the organizers shared power. The Standing Rock protest was much more egalitarian, much more collective. And as a result, there was a huge coalition of Native people and non-Native people, of over 300 different tribal nations represented at the protests. There was a vast coalition that came together in that protest. And although that protest didn't result in a stoppage of that pipeline, those people dispersed back into their communities and they kept on fighting in different ways. For instance, my tribe had previously voted to approve pipelines passing through Leech Lake Reservation. After Standing Rock, there is no way any of our tribal leaders could hope to remain in office if they continue to support pipelines. And that is a net positive effect of the Standing Rock protest. And that's true for other tribal communities around the country too. And so I think of Standing Rock as a really positive thing.
Yeah. I'm struck by just how optimistic, how hopeful you are about sort of where Native lives are these days. This is not the story that we normally hear.
It's not the story that a lot of outsiders normally hear, because when places like the New York Times and the New Yorker and other national media outlets tune into Native life, they tune in for the drama. Our society and Native people, we're not immune from this. We're a part of the society too. We've all been trained to sort of tune into Native issues and be titillated by it, to be titillated by the drama and by the suffering. The reporting on Native people is so often what I consider trauma porn. If I look at the New Yorker and I see this is a story about Native people, I know it's going to be some horrible story about how terrible life is. There was a photographic journalistic series called Postcards from Pine Ridge, which ran in the New Yorker by a photographer named Aaron Huey. And I knew what I was going to see before I opened this. I was not disappointed. One of the pictures was some kid in a diaper standing on a pile of trash on Pine Ridge Reservation. And all these pictures sort of evoked the destitution, the violence, the hopelessness, drug addiction, alcohol addiction. And I know enough people from Pine Ridge to know that while there may have been some girl standing in a pile of garbage, there were, you know, 20, 30, 40, 100, 200 other girls at home doing their homework, playing with Barbies, playing Pokemon, going to Girl Scouts, going camping, going to ceremonies, doing all the kinds of things that girls the world over do. But no one has focused on that stuff. So it's not news to me to notice and celebrate the wonderful sort of creativity and hard work and intelligence and beauty of Native people. I was surrounded by that. I had a mother who was a tough-minded, hardworking, brilliant, successful person, and she came from nothing. She came from the most destitute of circumstances. They had no running water in their house. She had to walk to a well in a village as though, you know, her story is one from the Middle Ages. But she went on to do all this amazing stuff, not in spite of her childhood, but in part because of it. And so Native people doing amazing things is not news to me, but it's certainly news I want to share with the rest of the world. And I want to undo the kind of reliance on tragedy narratives that storytelling about Native people has so often relied on. Tragedy is the dominant, if not the only, narrative mode with which people tell Native stories. And I really believe that how you tell the story shapes the story. How you see reality shapes that reality. And if we see our reality as tragic, then our reality will be tragic. But if we see our reality as being complicated, textured, layered, full of hard things, but full of other things too, well, then our reality will change as a result.
Don't worry about a thing.
That's Steve Paulson's conversation with David Troyer, author of The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. He's an Ojibwe writer from the Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota.
Long, so journey till the passion's gone. And leave a legacy of past batons. And when I'm passing on, remember me, yo, and blast this song. Come on.
You're listening to Superman, a renowned traditional Native American dancer. We're ending today's show on tribal sovereignty with his anthem called All Right.
Welcome to Mother Earth, where hurt people hurt people, and the birds are still chirping on the church steeple. Reverse the curse and reverse lethal. I ride rhymes, let my light shine, watch me murky, oh, yo.
Hey, we made a playlist of the songs you heard from this hour, plus a few more. Just go to ttbook.org and have a listen, and share it if you're inspired. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio and distributed by PRX. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's episode. He had help from Shannon Henry Kleiber and Angelo Bautista. Our technical director and sound designer is Joe Hartke, with help from Sarah Hopeful. Additional music this week from Black Belt Eagle Scout, Superman, Mata Wayuhi, Sergei Cheremisov, and Circus Marcus. The executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge is Steve Paulson, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Be well, and come back often.